Support comes from Pasadena Playhouse, presenting Jelly's Last Jam. Follow Jelly Roll Morton, the self-proclaimed inventor of jazz, in this ambitious musical masterpiece that's sure to blow the roof off the theater. Performances begin May 29th. Tickets at PasadenaPlayhouse.org.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us wherever you're listening in Southern California or increasingly listeners worldwide on the LAist app or at LAist.com. We're so glad to have you with us today. We have a jam-packed program, some fascinating topics and guests who are going to be taking part in the conversation. I just want to let you know that every week, midday Friday, we put out Air Talk Weekly. Air Talk Weekly is a newsletter in which I write about some of the interviews we've done over the course of the week. We pull back the curtain, talk about some of the things that I found most interesting or most moved me in the course of the interviews, a little bit of the backstory on booking it, and then we link to some of our favorite segments that our team has put together from the past week, and I explain why we've chosen the segments. We'd love to get this in your email inbox. It's free, of course, to sign up. All you need to do is go to LAist.com/airtalk, and you'll see right there where to put your email address in, and then to get signed up. It'll come your way every Friday, Air Talk Weekly, to stay in closer contact with the program and also to hear the thoughts I don't have time to share with you during the course of the day about the segments that we do. We begin with the very latest in campus protests across the United States. You heard top of the hour from NPR, what's happening on the East Coast. We are getting word that arrests are underway at Cal Poly Humboldt in Northern California right now, where there'd been an encampment that had been set up for many days. We've had a conflict over the weekend between dueling protesters at UCLA and at USC. There have been arrests because of an encampment there in a central part of the campus. With us to talk about all the events that are taking place at campuses throughout California is LAist reporter Yusra Farzan. Yusra, so good to have you with us again. First of all, I was just seeing something like 25 arrests have already happened up at Cal Poly Humboldt, so looks like a big day there.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Larry. Yes, a big day over there. This comes, I think, after about a week of tensions on the campus over there. We haven't really seen arrests in Southern California, apart from the one last week at USC on Wednesday, where over 90 protesters were arrested by the LAPD.
And at USC right now, tremendous controversy over how the university responded, first canceling the commencement and then canceling the speakers who were going to be at the large commencement, and then canceling that gathering that attracts nearly 60,000 people, satellite events going on, but some of the speakers look like they're going to be boycotting those events. What's the latest just with the tumult on campus?
Yeah, it has been an incredibly tense time on USC's campus. And like you mentioned, we had two speakers pull out, Booker Prize nominated author Si-Pham Zhang, as well as UCLA professor Safia Nobel, both withdrew as speakers from the Rossier School of Education satellite commencement ceremony. But yesterday, President Carol Folt did meet with some of the organizers of USC's encampment. The meeting, she said, she told LAist, lasted around 90 minutes. And she said that there was a faculty member present at the meeting as well. And she said that the students did not consider the meeting a win, but she appreciated that conversations were starting. And she did tell the student-run publication Annenberg Media that LAPD would not be called last night, and they weren't called. But the students released a statement saying that they were disappointed because President Folt, as well as the USC team, did not come prepared with any insights or concrete steps, and that Folt also said that she was unaware of the divestment campaign, which is, you know, one of their demands.
Yusra, what about a statement that's been signed at latest count I saw by over 300 USC faculty members calling on action be taken not just against President Folt, but against other administrators and for the campus to take significant steps to reverse what these faculty members see as bad actions by the university. Can you share a little bit about the genesis of this?
Yes. So we've actually seen faculty members from different schools put out statements of their own condemning what they call, you know, called the handling of the valedictorian speech controversy, as well as the in-camp demonstrations on campus. The academic executive board meeting is happening tomorrow, which President Folt and Provost Guzman are set to attend. And at this meeting, the faculty are calling on the Senate to censure Folt and Guzman for their handling of the speech as well as the protests. And over, as you mentioned, over 300 faculty members have signed this letter. Also worth mentioning that President Folt's contract with USC is up for renewal this year. She signed a five-year contract back in 2019.
All right. And are they calling for President Folt to not be renewed in her contract as a result of this controversy?
Yeah, so they've called for her to be censured. And if that vote of no confidence pass, they're demanding President Folt's and Provost Guzman's resignation.
All right. And you know, what's your sense of counter feelings on the USC campus? We saw at UCLA that there were a group of pro-Israeli demonstrators. There was a bit of conflict, some shoving that happened over the weekend at UCLA. Do you see much of any sort of a counter demonstration presence at USC?
We haven't seen counter demonstrations at USC, but Trojans for Israel released a statement last night where they have called on their USC administration to end the encampment because they say that it continues to marginalize and isolate Jewish and Zionist students on campus. And that, you know, some students, especially it's final season right now, they say these students feel intimidated just walking on campus. So they did release this statement last night.
One of the things I see in the demands in the faculty letter is asking the administration to issue an apology for deploying an, quote, outside agitators trope about student protesters. I had thought that the first day, this was very soon after the student who was scheduled to speak had her address canceled, that there were some protesters who were part of the group of Jewish protesters against Israel's military action who were part, at least I thought they identified themselves as part of that protest at USC. But have you been able to discern how much of the protesters are SC students versus those protesting this issue who have come onto campus to do it there?
We have seen on social media that some of those activists on campus are, you know, outside sources. We have reached out to LAPD as well for a list of the arrests to try and determine, you know, how many of these are students, trying to also get that information from USC. From when I was on campus, and right now campus is closed to media, so only those with a valid student ID or a valid USC ID or with business on campus can get in. So media is not allowed in right now. Or any outside agitators or outside activists for that matter. But the day that I was on campus, we noticed that there was a good group of students as well, in addition to some external activists.
Yusra, let's talk about some of the other universities locally. At UC Irvine, I see that there's an encampment at the Physical Science Quad. Do you have a sense of how many students are typically taking part in that encampment?
So at UC Irvine, it was a group of about 50 students who initially set up the encampment, and then they were joined by folks throughout the day. I did see on social media that there was a community call out to come, you know, join the encampment as well. Yesterday, Aldrich Hall, which is where it's the main administration building on UCI's campus, the floor where the chancellors and provost officers are located was put on lockdown, and there was a police presence on campus. Irvine's mayor, Farah Khan, attended the encampment, and, you know, she was in support of it, but she refused to speak with media, from what I'm being told. And she did release a statement, however, asking law enforcement to stand down. She did say that she would not tolerate any violations to students' rights to peacefully assemble and protest.
UC Riverside, an encampment has been set up at the university's Bell Tower lawn. And at Occidental College, Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace have put out a joint statement calling on the trustees to cease all current and future endowment investments in Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Elbit Systems, and Caterpillar, Inc., which I'm quoting from their statement, produce and provide the weapons being used to massacre Palestinian people. And there's a faculty group as well that released a statement in support of the students. This is all from USRA's reporting at LAS.com, where you can see her roundup of what's happening at all the different colleges and universities in Southern California. She's been very heavily on the road visiting campuses, trying to talk with people in the student body and administrators, law enforcement, if there have been contact with law enforcement at some of the campuses, just to hear what's taking place at those schools. Let me bring into the conversation USC Gould School of Law Professor Jody Armour, who is a frequent guest with us on Air Talk. Jody, the faculty representative that USRA mentioned, he was there with the students in their conversation with President Carol Folt yesterday. And my understanding is there is another meeting between the students and President Folt that is scheduled for this afternoon. Jody, it's good to have you with us again. Good morning.
Good to be with you, Larry. Thanks for having me.
So how would you characterize the conversation with President Folt yesterday?
I thought the students acquitted themselves extremely well. They were eloquent and passionate and very professional and honorable in their interactions. They articulated their concerns and their demands. And I frankly thought that, Larry, that kind of conversation that the president was having with the students at that table yesterday, she could have had with them last Wednesday. You know, I came on the campus early when they were setting up the protest. I was there about 7:30 a.m. They had a yoga and meditation group at kind of 8 a.m. Then 9, they had a poetry reading, then an informational setting. If the president had just come out of her office and walked over to the little grassy area we were on and sat down with students and maybe brought some donuts and said, let's talk, let's discuss your concerns, let's see if we can find some common ground. If she'd done then what she did yesterday, I think a lot of this could have been avoided. But instead, the reflex was to reach for, you know, kind of LAPD, DPS response, which only escalated matters.
Professor, I wonder, though, because, you know, the president is caught between undoubted pressures that she has from alumni and from donors who are not happy with the kind of rhetoric that has come from some of the protesters, not all of them, but some of them that they consider to be extreme, in some cases anti-Semitic. And so she's trying to respond to that constituency and hopefully respect freedom of speech on the university's campus. What do you think is a better way for her to balance those competing pressures and interests?
Yeah, good question, Larry. You know, the university in 2018 had Ben Shapiro come to campus, and there was a lot of this kind of controversy, too. Some students felt unsafe, you know, from marginalized groups, some of the groups that he seemed to be attacking. Some people viewed him as an avowedly virulent kind of racist. And so they were feeling very strongly about his coming to Bovard. He filled the auditorium. But the provost at the time, Michael Quick, said the sacred value of our university is free speech and freedom of expression. So we are going to have this talk. We're going to allow Ben Shapiro to talk. We're going to beef up security. They did. Protesters marched around Bovard. you know, through the evening. And then the next day, we celebrated as a community our ability to both protect free speech interests and advance the safety of the students. And that isn't what happened with Asna Tabassum, students said. You know, one of the things that the president said yesterday at the meeting was that, you know, you didn't follow rules. That's why I had to release, you know, kind of deploy DPS and LAPD. And the students, always keen observers of hypocrisy, pointed out, well, you didn't follow rules with Asna Tabassum. You know, all valedictorians had been permitted to give the valedictorian commencement address up until Asna Tabassum, the Muslim student, before she even wrote her speech. So you didn't even know what she was going to say. So, you know, don't lecture us on following the rules. So it is a tough balancing act, Larry. But I think, you know, if she had come over and sat in the encampment and said, we are balancing these competing interests. I want to talk to you about that. Let's find some common ground. That would have made a big difference.
We're talking with UCLA Gould School of Law Professor Jody Armour, who was at that meeting yesterday between USC President Carol Folt and a group of the students who were pro-Palestinian demonstrators, protesters on the USC campus involved in the encampment there. Professor, what's your hope for the meeting this afternoon? First, are you gonna be at that meeting today?
Yes, I'll be there. At yesterday's meeting, there were four students, three undergraduates, and one graduate student. There was President Folt with the University Council by her side and a student resource officer. So those were the folks who were in the room. We're going to have those same folks in the room. President Folt said she was going to look at the students' demands, weigh them overnight, and come back with a response today. And so we're going to see what that response is and if we can make some progress from there.
Realistically, it's unlikely that the university is going to say, you know, we're going to go into all of our investment accounts, which are bundled with all kinds of different investments, and, you know, pull out of those that have certain companies that are involved or that have investment in Israel. You know, short of the university doing something like that, what do you think would be seen as a gain for the students?
Yeah, we had these same discussions and debates, Larry, when I was a student, when I was their age. Back in my day, when I was on campus, it was about divestment from South Africa, the South African apartheid regime. And initially, you know, university would say, well, you know, we have these funds invested, we can't get to them. We eventually were able to achieve quite a bit of progress there. It takes some time. But outside that, the students are also asking for a full amnesty for all students, staff, and faculty who were arrested or penalized in any way. That should be a pretty straightforward kind of response. Some are asking for an academic boycott of Israel. This happened with South Africa, too. I remember we had those kind of boycotts, academic boycott with Israel. That, you know, police on campus, rethinking the role of police on campus, something we were doing back in 2020, is a militarized kind of presence of police on campus now. That's something that might be addressable. So there may be some items that can't, real progress can be made on, Larry.
As you know, the bigger challenge in terms of divestment is, you know, back with the South African government, it's not like there were a lot of supporters of the South African government and its apartheid policies here. In the U.S., there obviously is significant support for Israel, for Zionism, and for Israel to continue to be its own independent nation. So that would complicate, of course, divestment efforts when you have that kind of significant support, which South Africa didn't enjoy in this country.
Right. Initially, you're absolutely right. Although I remember being on the front lines back in those days, Larry, you know, people were arguing on both sides. They were saying, well, maybe we shouldn't divest. We should engage. And through our engagement, we can bring about more change in South Africa than if we follow this boycott, divestment, and sanction kind of approach that you student protesters want. So there was some controversy there, but you're right. There's more kind of split of opinion here, more polarization. But that was also true of Vietnam, right? And we had a lot of this same kind of polarization in Vietnam. But over time, a consensus evolved. And I think with respect to Gaza, people are starting to say, well, you know, kind of collective punishment, starvation, some of these, you know, 13,000, 14,000 children are so far There's a growing consensus that, especially among, I notice a lot of students of all denominations, Jewish students, come out forcefully. Some in Jewish Voices for Peace have come on campus, et cetera. So we'll see where this goes in the coming weeks and months. But, even with respect to Iraq, our opinions change and rapidly in a matter of months. So we'll see what the consensus is in a couple months, Larry.
Jody, thanks so much. And I hope perhaps we'll get a chance to talk with you tomorrow morning after the second meeting with President Folt. Thanks so much for coming on with us, Professor. We always appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Larry.
That's UCLA Gould School of Law Professor Jody Armour. He'll be back with USC President Carol Folt this afternoon. We reached out to the office of President Folt as well as to Provost Andrew T. Guzman, who put out the original statement to the SC campus community that the student would not be making her valedictory address. And we have not heard back from either of the administrators at USC. We hope to have them with us talking about their decision at some point, particularly with very, very few details about the security threat that they said that they received, which led them to cancel Asna Tabassum's valedictory address. It's Air Talk on LA, it's 89.3. Coming up, a lengthy article in the New York Times, which really describes a number of the internal and external challenges faced by NPR. We'll be back in a minute. It's Air Talk on LA, it's 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. Coming up next hour on Air Talk, we'll be joined by GOP pollster Patrick Ruffini. His career goes back to the George W. Bush administration. His new book contends that what we're seeing in the sorting of American politics is largely driven by whether one has a college education or not. His book is Party of the People Inside the Multiracial Populist Coalition, Remaking the GOP. We'll hear what he has to say and hear what analysis he has of the demographic data on voting. That comes up next hour. But we turn our attention right now to NPR. LAist, of course, is a very long time NPR member station. And NPR is a network that has a membership model where you've got the leaders of multiple stations who are really the ones giving direction to the network. But that has not stopped historically, there being significant tension in the governance and operation of NPR. But in my 40-plus years in public radio, this may be the most intense I've ever seen it. You have criticism that recently came from former senior business editor Uri Berliner in an essay in the Free Press in which he criticized NPR for a number of reasons, including its lack of political diversity among its staff and his view of how that affected the coverage of stories. He was also critical of what he thought was an overemphasis on race in the way that stories were chosen and told, and that NPR was not necessarily as curious or soul-searching as it needed to be to do the best journalism. Well, Uri has since left NPR. We talked with David Folkenflik about that development, but that's just one piece. NPR is further facing some highly significant and threatening financial challenges. And in Benjamin Mullen's New York Times piece, the media reporter details what's going on with criticism of NPR's content as well as concerns about its future as a going concern given the economic challenges it faces. Ben Mullen, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about your lengthy and I thought extremely well-written piece in the Times.
Thanks so much for saying that. I'm delighted to be here.
Let me begin with the sources that you used for this. Some were on the record. Some obviously were not. How reluctant or agreeable were the people you contact to share their views about NPR and its current challenges?
This is one of the things I love about NPR, and I think it's part and parcel of the fact that you're having me on today, is that maybe it's because NPR receives public funding, or maybe it's because there's a real spirit of open inquiry at the network, but people were remarkably candid in their conversations with me, And they were willing to talk to me, I think in part because there's a tradition of doing this at NPR. And also people love the network so much and they want to see it thrive.
I was struck by how many, I read a fair number of the reader comments to your piece. It really connected with Times readers. And how many said, I used to listen to NPR, I'm left of center, I'm sort of the target demographic. I used to listen all the time, but I really don't anymore. It doesn't have the same appeal to me. I don't know how many of those comments you've had a chance to read, but what was your reaction to the ones you did?
It was so interesting because when I was first starting to work on the story with my coworker Jeremy Peters, I was kind of coming at the story from the business perspective. Like, here are the business challenges of NPR, and Jeremy was pointing out that he had been hearing from sources who, had started to tune out some of NPR's coverage because they felt that it was too some of it was too focused on identity politics. And it was interesting that sort of when you looked at some of the comments, there were a lot of people who seemed to echo what Jeremy had told me when I started working on the story with him like 8 months ago.
There are so many complexities of what's going on. It's kind of hard because one goes into the other and goes into the other. But clearly NPR is facing, much as LAist is at the local level, huge pressure from a decline in advertising. And that makes it then very difficult to keep staffing strong and to be able to respond to all the editorial demands on a newsroom. And I wonder with NPR specifically if you can get into some of these economic challenges, because they've done very well with podcasts. As you write in your story in the Times, I think 3 of the top 10 global podcasts are NPR pods. So clearly it's connecting with an audience on the newer platform. It's not like they're losing broadcast, not gaining in podcast, but they're not making that up in advertising. So what's going on there?
My read of what's happening based on folks I've talked to and looking at NPR's financial filings is that podcasting has been a huge, huge boon for NPR. As you mentioned, they have a bunch of podcasts that are real juggernauts in terms of listenership. But the problem with, relying on advertising for growth is that, as you know, when the advertising market tracks more or less to the U.S. economy writ large. And so when the U.S. economy hit the skids last year, a couple years ago, sponsorship revenue declined, and that resulted in NPR having to make some cuts. So I think it's kind of a double-edged sword. But overall, podcasting has been really beneficial and has greatly increased NPR's sponsorship revenue.
NPR, according to Ben Mullen in his piece with Jeremy Peters from the New York Times, has an audience of 42 million weekly listeners. Many of those are listening on digital platforms. That's something we found here at LAist as well, that for some of what we've lost in listening to the broadcast signal, we're picking up from the smartphone app or the website. People are listening other ways or downloading the podcasts of AirTalk, for example. We have significant listenership to the podcast on all the typical podcasting platforms. But the audience has declined over the past 4 years from 60 million to 42 million. That is a bigger fall off, according to Ben in his reporting, than we have seen for broadcast radio. And what are the theories for the people that you talked with, Ben, for such a dramatic drop off in listening?
There's a bunch of theories. First of all, this is not just an NPR problem. As you point out, every media company is dealing with a decline in audience on its traditional platforms. For example, fewer people read the New York Times in print than did, 40, 50 years ago. Fewer people are watching traditional cable television than they did 30 years ago. So some of it is just that traditional businesses get really mature and profitable, and then they erode. Some of it is, the pandemic, a lot of NPR's listenership, its traditional radio listenership, comes through people who are commuting. And obviously, the pandemic totally changed commuting patterns. So that had effect as well. And then I think the third thing is where digital audiences are concerned, one thing you're seeing across the board is that there are that social media networks like Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, and search engines like Google are sending fewer viewers to owned and operated websites writ large. So that's another problem.
And news fatigue. I think it's just hard to overstate news fatigue. Anecdotally, I talk with so many people who say, I just don't consume as much news. I'm burned out. It's so intense. It's so partisanly focused. And there's so much vitriol that I just don't feel that I can let it into my life at the same level I did in the past. Now, I don't know how well we have made objective measures of that, but it's something that I sure hear a lot, and I think is a real thing, this idea of news fatigue. And, you know, maybe later in the election year, we'll see more people gravitate toward news. I mean, one of the ways we've tried to respond with Air Talk is that we do more non-news segments, things that, as part of having the biggest conversation in Southern California, we ask people to come together and talk about things that are just quality of life, that are fun things, that are maybe interesting aspects of what it means to be a Southern Californian, or topics in psychology, healthcare, things that are not strictly politics to try and address that news fatigue. But Ben, my sense is that is a big factor, and that has led to some declines in listening.
Right. And you're right that it's hard to quantify how many people are tuning out because they don't feel like they're getting value from the part of the discussion around partisan politics. I would note that, in 2016 and sort of in early 2021, there was a huge spike across all news organizations because audiences were glued to coverage of the election and they were glued to coverage of the aftermath of the election. We haven't seen a similar spike for political coverage in 2024, and I kind of wonder whether viewers are just kind of done with it. The other thing I would say is that this political campaign, you know, you have Trump, you know, spending a lot of time in the courtroom, campaigning from the courthouse steps, and you have Biden not making a lot of campaign appearances and also kind of obviating the traditional media by going on, broadcasts like Howard Stern. And so I think all of that is in the soup here.
One of the issues, Ben, about demographics of NPR listeners is with efforts to try and diversify the listening audience, you say that according to the Pew Research Center, as of 2020, still 75% of NPR listeners were white. That's more than any other news outlet except for Fox News. That would be the only one that's whiter. And I wonder how much of that is historic patterns of college education, because historically NPR has really been aimed at and connects most effectively with college graduates. This, in fact, an issue we're going to get to next hour with Patrick Ruffini for his book. And so I wonder, as we see increasing numbers of college-educated graduates of color, whether we're going to start to see some significant movement on that, diversifying the audience or not. What's the sense inside NPR of what's going to drive that diversification?
There was a presentation to NPR's board last fall in which they presented statistics for NPR's podcast listenership among Black people and Hispanic people. And what those statistics showed was that despite this big effort that NPR has made over the last 4 or 5 years to diversify its staff and its content, the percentage of Black listenership for those podcasts had stayed the same. And the percentage of listenership among Hispanic listeners was only up by 2%. And this happened as the overall audience had decreased. So it was really discouraging to the board members who saw this presentation. And I'm optimistic. I hope you're right. But so far, the data doesn't bear it out, I don't think.
Yeah, interesting. Because I think for many of us, that was what we're sort of hanging our hat on, is that as the public radio audience ages, it and newer listeners come to it, it's going to be a more diverse audience as long as we're culturally relevant and talking about things that are of interest to college graduates of diverse backgrounds. And if that's not happening, then that is a serious threat to the future of public broadcasting. Ben, I need to make a break, and I know you're not scheduled to go longer. Could you spend some more time with us this hour? Because there's just so much more for us to get into in your reporting here.
Yeah, happy to.
That would be great. Okay, we're going to hold then Benjamin Mullen over, media reporter for the New York Times. And I welcome your calls. You know, I don't think it's that interesting just call in and have folks beat up on or say how great NPR is, but I'm interested in your analysis of what you hear on NPR, what you see as the future of public broadcasting, your thoughts based on the issues that Benjamin Mullen and I are talking about as laid out in his New York Times story of last Wednesday. We're at 866-893-5722. 866-893-5722. You can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name or comment on the AirTalk page at las.com/airtalk. We'll be back in 90 seconds. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. As we're talking with Benjamin Mullen, media reporter for the New York Times, his extensive piece, written along with his Times colleague Jeremy W. Peters, looks at a number of pressures that NPR is facing, criticism of its framing or choice of stories. We have real financial concerns within NPR that it's trying to deal with. And I just want to say, because we are a member station of NPR, that so many of the things that the network is dealing with are things that we deal with locally as well, particularly the funding issue. We, too, have seen a dramatic decrease in what we call underwriting, but it's essentially advertising, as ad dollars have moved elsewhere. And the pandemic really shook things up in that way. Secondly, and Ben made this point about people's commuting habits changing dramatically, people not typically going into the office every day of the week. So that changes habits around radio listening. More people listening to podcasts, but when they listen to podcasts, are they listening to the podcasted versions of things they used to listen to on radio, or are they listening to a wide range of other things that hadn't been available when they were limited on their commute to what's on the radio dial? My question for you as an AirTalk listener is, as you look at this analytically, I'm really interested in your thoughts. The New York Times readers who responded to Ben's piece, there's some really thoughtful and very interesting analysis that were included in some of those postings. And I'm really asking for us to kind of do the same, to analyze our way through this, not just, you know, bash NPR or praise NPR, or, you know, just to talk about what we think is going on and what would be in the best interests of public service journalism. You know, Ben, one of the things that we're very committed to here at LAist is really making the shift to digital, making sure that our audience has access to and that the content is so compelling at LAist.com or on our LAist app that the places where people are going, the platforms that they're going for news, that we're there and we're serving the community in doing that. Within NPR, how is that digital transformation playing out?
It's a good question. I think that NPR, like every news organization, has tried to figure out how to get people to pay in some way for the news on the internet. NPR is kind of unique among many of its competitors in the sense that because of its public interest mission, it basically doesn't, it's not asking people to sign up for a subscription so that they can access the news. So what NPR has decided to do is to ask people to donate through the NPR network, which is kind of this newish network-wide fundraising organization that they set up. They've also started asking people to pay for extras to podcasts. And that business has been pretty sluggish so far. So I'd say that's how it's going. They're really trying to make a business off of its digital content. But as we know, that's really, really difficult.
Kevin in Long Beach emailed us, I have a feeling the listenership declines aren't due to the way NPR handles news, but the news itself. There are just so many distressing things happening that even news that shoots it straight is tough to stomach. Whatever it is, I hope it's temporary. The drop in quality on a local level due to cash struggles is glaring. Kevin, thank you. Kevin talking about the fact that local media is just being decimated. Print media, seeing what's happening locally, for those of us that love to consume news, not, you know, just aren't in the business, most of us work in it, are huge news consumers, very concerning. Guy in Tustin emailed, I've been listening to NPR, in particular KPCC/LAist, for many years. My problem with listening over the last few years is that so much of NPR is biased to a more liberal perspective. I've sent Larry emails over the years talking about episodes where there was no or little conservative counterpoint, or the conservative guest was so weak in his conversation the liberal guest took over the discussion. I'm moderate with liberal but also conservative leanings. I've always listened to NPR for unbiased reporting and deep dives on stories, but so many times many of the conversations take a heavy lean toward the liberal side of social issues, spending of tax money, and legal issues. Where I wanted clarity and true discussion, I got one-sided viewpoints. I think this without bias slogan that you claim is not honest, and NPR, and in particular LAist, needs to really look at the issue. That's Guy in Tustin. We're at 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@laist.com. Please include your location and first name. Jeremy in Hollywood, good to have you with us. Jeremy, please share with us how your listening habits to NPR have changed, if they have.
Thank you, Larry. So I used to listen to NPR exclusively while commuting. I'm 33 years old, so during my early professional life, sitting in traffic, I'd only listen to NPR. And then during COVID, my commuting habits changed, and you know, sitting at home, and I found that the coverage of NPR for COVID especially was just very one-sided. I don't have this particular bias. I consider myself very moderate, but it just seemed like, you know, it just was very one-sided. And now, you know, I've discovered other listening platforms for news. And I'd say in particular, I listen to Crystal and Sagar on Breaking Points quite frequently because I find it to be more middle of the road and nuance, and they cover more hard news.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I like your show a lot for the local stuff, and I'd say, you know, keep interviewing Karen Bass and challenging the city council, and that's all great, but for general NPR, you know, I feel like it can just be very one-sided and not, you know, hard-hitting coverage.
Jeremy, I appreciate your call. Thank you very much. Sally in Palm Desert says, I have tons of Latino friends. None of them use the term Latinx. None of them. I feel like NPR has become a sort of esoteric college. I'm a lifelong Democrat. I still feel like I'm hearing an echo chamber. Mira in Irvine says, a feeling I've had recently is that although my politics align with most of what I hear on NPR, I've been dismayed by the lack of objectivity in the stories they cover. Howard in Corona Del Mar, I'm one of those white college grad listeners who've become disaffected and estranged. NPR no longer carries topics interesting to me. I was distressed at the management's reaction to Uri Berliner's thoughtful criticism of NPR. That's Howard in Corona Del Mar. Richard in Tarzana said, we used to have three major TV networks, and that was it. Now there's more competition and news fatigue. 866 893-5722. John in West LA says, I feel agenda-driven journalism makes a news organization predictable and lessens the critical quality of its writing. In my opinion, if editors seek a point of view, it impacts the hook and conversation of the writing that brings people in. And Frida in West L.A. Says, I love NPR and LAist, and I love the news you present, but I do think the coverage moves too quickly between stories without time to process in between. Frida, one of the things that everybody in radio tries to balance is your listeners who are coming and going, getting in and out of the car, moving between segments of their day. And so you have to be very make sure that you're not alienating those listeners with the length of segments. And then the flip side of that, providing enough time to give you the depth to really get into things. We're at 866-893-5722. Hal in Azusa, good to have you with us on Air Talk.
Hi, Larry. This is Hal. Thank you so much. I love your programming and all of NPR. I've listened for over 40 years. However, I do want to say that although the news and features are very well documented, facts are really sought out, I find that often multiple perspectives are not gained. For instance, the Palestine protests now, I rarely hear from those who think maybe it's not a good idea to break the law. And from people from different sides of it, even the guest this morning was a faculty member supporting the protests. And I think this is a common thing that I see. Well done for all you do, but I'd like to hear from different sides to stories.
All right. Al, I appreciate it very much. Thank you. 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@laist.com. Please include your location and first name. And this is so valuable to hear on a local public radio program, on an NPR member station, what people think about what they hear. Ashley in Newport Beach, I just want to echo a lot of what I've heard here. I feel like the unbiased news moniker is no longer true. I'm loyal to LAist, but also feel there's a definite bias. That's Ashley in Newport Beach. 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@laist.com. Please include your location and first name. You know, one thing I should just share is, for people who've been longtime listeners to Air Talk, you probably recall that we had many more Republican elected officials on this program in years past than we do now. And that's not for lack of trying on our part, but I think as we have become increasingly politically polarized, there are many Republican election officials who do not want to come on a local public radio station. And I can only surmise why that is, whether they feel they're not going to be treated fairly, whether they feel like they're not going to be talking to their constituents or potential voters who would provide political benefit to them. I could only guess. I don't know the reasons, but I have to tell you, when we would call Southern California Republican elected officials to come on in years past, we would have no problem getting them on. And it's a very, very different kind of experience now. Let's see, Sky in Palm Springs emailed, I listen to NPR every day for probably a decade. I love NPR. I still love NPR. I love Air Talk and the work you do. But since 2020, NPR's coverage has become so one-sided and consumed by identity politics, I can no longer get through an entire episode of any show. I want NPR to succeed, and so I hope NPR takes Uri's criticism to heart and makes some serious changes. Now, Benjamin Mullen, media reporter for The New York Times. Ben, what's been the response to the essay by Uri and his critique of the lack of political diversity in hiring and in stories? How is NPR responding to that?
I just want to take a minute to observe, speaking of response, how incredibly engaged people are with NPR. Our story, you're the emails you read out, you've gotten dozens of emails, and it's been less than an hour since you introduced the segment and all these calls. So I just want to say, like, it's clear people really care. And I think that's one of the reasons why we heard from so many people expressing similar sentiments to what you just said. There were a lot of people who weighed in saying that you know, that they were lifelong liberals who agreed with Uri's sentiments that said that NPR had focused too much around issues of identity politics. And there were people who said basically that they think that, you know, that NPR is doing important work and shining a spotlight on issues that normally wouldn't get attention. So I think you're basically hearing from people across the spectrum.
And I was curious internally, though, is NPR, and we're almost out of time, but is it doing soul searching? I've got like 20 seconds for that response, Ben.
I haven't heard anything from management to make it seem like they really listened to Uri's criticism.
All right. I want to thank you so much. Let me just quickly share some other comments. We have Tanya in West LA. I'm a lifelong liberal, but finding the news coverage has so much bias baked in, it's losing credibility with listeners. I think it's become a more progressive, almost fringe view that's turning people off without counterpoint. Connor in West Adams District says, I'm discouraged by some of the validation of right-wing ideology on NPR. How can you do both sides when one country is very far from the truth in our country? My thanks to Benjamin Mullen, media reporter for The New York Times, who wrote this lengthy piece about NPR and its challenges. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. The Associated Press, citing sources, says the USDEA is going to move to reclassify marijuana as a less dangerous drug. This would be a massive shift in how marijuana is treated. The DEA proposal, according to the Associated Press, still must be reviewed by the White House Office of Management and Budget. It would recognize the medical use of cannabis and acknowledge it has less potential for abuse than some of the nation's most dangerous drugs. However, it would not legalize marijuana. The agency's move was confirmed today to the Associated Press. They say five people familiar with the matter spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss the sensitive regulatory review. Again, AP says through five sources that the USDEA will move to reclassify marijuana as a less dangerous drug, though they don't have the final word. It still has to go through the White House Office of Management and Budget. We turn our attention now to California's SB 5, which allowed for the construction of multi-unit projects in neighborhoods that had been zoned for single-family homes. A number of cities fought this, concerned that it would dramatically add density and detract from the quality of life in those single-family home communities. Five Southern California cities, Redondo Beach, Carson, Torrance, Whittier, and Del Mar, sued against the implementation of SB 9, and they prevailed in this first step. An LA Superior Court judge ruled that SB 9 is unconstitutional. The judge, Curtis Kinn, said that SB 9 does not provide housing restricted for low-income residents. Therefore, it can't override state constitutional protections for local zoning practices. Joining us to talk about this is attorney Pam Lee, who represented the cities who were the plaintiffs in this case. She's with the firm Alsher and Winder. Thank you so much, Pam, for being with us. So share with us, what was the specific claim that your client cities were making in this suit?
Thank you. Our clients were basically claiming that we all understand and believe that housing and affordable housing is a matter of statewide concern. There's no dispute there. But for charter cities, if a state is going to enact a law that is a matter of statewide concern and that is within the traditional realm of municipal affairs and local governance, they have to meet certain steps and requirements in order to do so. Namely, that it has to be reasonably related to the purpose of affordable housing. And two, that it has to be narrowly tailored in order to avoid unnecessary interference in local governance. And basically, those two findings were not made by the state legislature when they passed SB 9. And as a result, it's invalid as to charter cities because of the fact that they just failed to meet these findings.
But if the idea behind SB 9 and the legislators was that by increasing the housing stock generally, particularly in areas where there's transit, that is going to have its own kind of pressure on prices and in the long term making housing more affordable under the supply-demand equation. So why would that not be de facto speaking to the creation of more moderately priced housing?
I think that with housing overall and housing affordability, certainly the increase in supply to a certain amount would potentially have some sort of effect on housing prices. But first, I think housing overall is not a single commodity. I do think that there's different price points for housing. And to a certain extent, you can build as many $5 million homes as you can, but they'll never make the houses that are around affordable to a level that is purported to affect and provide housing for those of lower income, which is what affordable housing is supposed to do, and specifically affordable housing legislation. And SB 9 was created specifically for affordable housing, which is defined to mean housing that is below market rate or housing that is affordable to those who are below median income. The state has enacted many laws with respect to promoting housing overall and housing affordability, and they've made separate findings to that. SB 9 was not one of those laws that talks about general housing and housing affordability. It was specifically for a type of housing.
All right. We're talking with Pam Lee, attorney who represented the plaintiffs, which were the five cities in this case, Redondo, Carson, Torrance, Whittier, and Del Mar. SB 9 was passed in 2020, and it increased the density of housing allowed in single-family neighborhoods. It gives homeowners the right to split single-family lots and build up to four units of housing on that lot. Now, these zones make up 78% of residential land in Southern California. So you're looking at a large part of the land that would be buildable with up to four units on what's currently a single-family home. Also joining us from UC Davis, Professor of Law Christopher Elmendorf. His expertise includes property and land use law. Professor Elmendorf, welcome.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
What do you think of the judge's, Judge Kinn's reading of the law and his declaration that SB 9 is unconstitutional?
So I think it's important for listeners to understand that this ruling is both very narrow and very strange. The judge did not say that the legislature cannot pass a law that does exactly what SB 9 does in order to increase the supply of housing. What he said instead was that SB 9 unambiguously has one and only one purpose, which is to increase the supply of below market rate housing. That is housing that is sold or rented at a price that is less than what a normal willing buyer, willing seller would exchange the property for. And because that was the sole and unambiguous purpose of SB 9, the substance of the law was irrational relative to that purpose, because the law did not require that SB 9 projects include price-restricted or deed-restricted housing that can only be sold at a below-market price. And what makes this so strange is that the legislature just said in SB 9 that we're doing this to increase the supply of affordable housing. It didn't say anything about below-market rate housing. And the only way that you can infer that the term affordable housing in this law has an unambiguous meaning of promoting the development of below market rate housing, the only way you can get to that conclusion is to assume that the legislature itself is irrational.
Well,
because why would they pass a law joke with here, sole but purpose without requiring the thing that they allegedly had the sole purpose to affect?
So I'm just having a little trouble following. So the judge saying that the legislature didn't really intend for this to create additional affordable housing, that's not the intent because they didn't explicitly lay that out?
Yes, the judge said that the legislature used the term affordable housing in its statement of findings, its purpose. And the term affordable housing, according to the judge, unambiguously means one thing and one thing only, which is housing that is sold or rented at less than its market value.
All right.
But that's obviously wrong because the term affordable housing has many meanings, right? One meaning could be price-restricted housing. Another meaning could just be what people sometimes call naturally affordable housing, or housing that, because it's smaller or older, sells or rents for a lower price than some other housing. And so the legislature used the term affordable housing without explaining what it meant by it. But the substance of the law tells you what the legislature meant by it.
Pam Lee, can you respond to that and why you think the judge didn't see it that way?
Absolutely. And I think it boils down to what's written in statutes. And obviously words have meaning. And in statutory law, every single instance in which the term affordable housing has been used in the government code, in the health and safety code, in every other statute in which findings were made, affordable housing has been meant to mean expressly below market rate housing or housing that is affordable to those below median income. Now, the state legislature has, like I said before, adopted several laws that talked about improving access to housing and housing affordability, meaning trying to decrease the general prices of housing, considering the exorbitant prices that they have on the overall market. Back when the Housing Crisis Act was adopted in 2017, the legislature made findings that they wanted to improve housing for all income levels. They also specifically made a finding that they wanted to improve access to affordable housing specifically. Had the legislature done that for SB 9, it would be a different case. But because the legislature passed SB 9 specifically for affordable housing, we can only interpret affordable housing to mean that which the legislature had interpreted before, which under the government code, health and safety code, and all other statutes is meant, like I said before, below market rate housing. Be that as it may, that's why we have the laws and the findings that are required. It may be ridiculous, but unfortunately, that's what the legislature did.
It is simply false. It is simply false to say that the legislature has only used affordable housing in this one respect. And to give you just one contrary example, I would point to SB 684, which is a law the legislature passed just last year, in which they made an explicit finding in finding N that the production of new market rate housing frees up existing more affordable housing elsewhere in the region for sale or rent to middle and lower income households.
Pam Lee?
Yes, that may be true, but in the findings that they made that express finding with the evidence and the facts to support how building housing at different market levels will affect housing at all income levels. If they're talking about affordable housing and specifically using the term affordable housing, we need to look at what this legislature has done. And in all of the government codes and the health and safety codes in which that term is used, it really has meant below market rate.
So, Pam Lee,
could
the legislature come back with a revised SB 9 that has that more explicit language and pass that and then invalidate the argument that your client cities are making?
Yes. I mean, you know, the point of this law is not to go against housing, but really to require both cities and the state to follow what the law says. And if they're going to make a law that is applicable to charter cities, they have to meet the requirements. And in order to do so, SB 9 would have had to have separate findings other than what was already included. And they can go back and amend SB 9 to either include an affordability component, or they can make revised findings with respect to how it is supposed to be narrowly tailored and how it's supposed to be reasonably related to either affordable housing or general housing overall at all income levels. That would certainly do the fix.
Let me ask you, because there are the five cities here that were plaintiffs in the case that you represent. The judge's ruling clearly applies to the five. What about other charter cities in California? Is this operative for them, or would they have to take separate legal action?
Well, currently the trial court is not necessarily binding on, other charter cities in California that are certainly not within the county's jurisdiction. And so this would have to go on appeal and be, confirmed before it's applicable elsewhere. But I know that, a separate legal action would look to this as not necessarily binding authority, but potentially persuasive authority as to what will happen to those charter cities.
And Professor Elmendorf, it sounds like your thought is this has a high likelihood of being overturned.
Yes, I think it has a high likelihood of being overturned, certainly in the Court of Appeal, but in all likelihood, I would imagine the legislature will respond first.
Okay. And you think the legislature is more likely to amend the bill just to sidestep any court action on this?
Yeah, they just have to make a new finding and then this case goes away.
All right. I want to thank you both so much. Christopher Elmendorf, UC Davis law professor with expertise in property and land use law, and Pam Lee, attorney with Altshire Windeyer, who represented the plaintiffs and the cities in this case. The five cities are Carson, Torrance, Whittier, Redondo Beach, and Del Mar. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up, the future of coffee. Are you ready to switch to coffee that doesn't include coffee beans? I don't know. That just sounds morally wrong to me. But there's actually a moral case for making coffee without coffee beans. And we're going to hear what it is when we come back in just 1 minute. Coming up in just a few minutes on Air Talk, we'll be speaking with longtime Republican pollster Patrick Ruffini. He is noted for his demographic analysis, and he has a new book, Party of the People, Inside the Multiracial Populist Coalition, Remaking the GOP. We'll talk about what he says is a pretty dramatic shifting of Americans' political orientations, with non-college-educated Americans gravitating towards Republican populism, and as the Democratic Party being largely a party for college graduates. We'll talk with him about how this resorting is occurring and what the implications of it are. But for those of us that love coffee, and I certainly am in that camp, there could be some disruption in our daily rituals. Climate change is having a very significant impact on global coffee production. With less predictability in the climate, coffee farmers are forced to contend with erratic rain, warming temperatures, new types of pests, and they're seeing yields diminishing. This is happening as demand for coffee is growing worldwide. In countries like China, the demand for coffee keeps getting bigger and bigger. So the question is, is the demand going to be met by the ability to cultivate coffee? Are we going to see, for example, more coffee being cultivated in the United States as the climate shifts? Is that going to be a potential answer? Or what about beanless coffee made of everything from upcycled date pits to fermented roots and seeds? Joining us is Vern Long, CEO of World Coffee Research, a global agricultural research organization. Vern, thank you so much. It's good to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
So how much stress is on coffee producers right now, given what's happening with the climate and deforestation concerns and all these other stressors?
Absolutely. With the current environment that producers are facing, there are challenges to production even now when the full force of climate change hasn't even yet arrived. And that's primarily a function of lack of innovation for smallholder farmers. So while Brazil, Colombia, and Vietnam have had long-standing robust innovation for supporting their farmers, their coffee farmers are doing very well, responding to current challenges and taking on the challenges of the future with climate change. But many of the smallholder farmers on which our industry depends, 12.5 million smallholders contribute to a substantial portion of global supply. And they're facing big challenges now because they just don't have the technology necessary to take on the challenges the environment's sending their way.
So this is an industry on the agricultural side that really hasn't seen consolidation in the way wine has, for example. And I wonder, is that something that could be coming in the future to get economies of scale and to introduce the kind of technology and ability to deal with climate changes that the small farmers can't?
I think that while there is a story of doom and gloom out there, I think one of the exciting things, and it's what motivates me to pursue science in support of smallholder farmers, is that innovation can be scale neutral. You can develop innovations that make smallholder farmers prosperous and profitable. And consolidation isn't necessarily what's required for those smallholders to be successful in global markets. When we talk about consolidation generally in coffee, we're generally talking about consolidation at an origin level. So we've seen over the last 10, 15 years that Brazil and Vietnam have really surged to the front, producing a very large amount of our total global supply. And so many of the second tier origins, Guatemala, Honduras, Ethiopia, Uganda, they haven't really maintained the levels of productivity we see in Brazil. And so that's where you start to see consolidation, is that a growing portion of our coffee globally is coming from fewer and fewer origins. But the exciting part about this is that we can actually generate technologies to help smallholders be successful. There's certainly a limited land size. You can't have just, 10 trees and try to make a go of only coffee farming. But certainly farmers who are on smallholder producers can be successful. And I think that's where we need to have both technological innovations and social innovations like marketing and co-ops that enable smaller producers to get an opportunity in the global markets.
What role does the U.S. have in this? We're such a big coffee consuming country. Are there more things that we can do to help some of those smaller coffee farmers be able to beef up production and to be more efficient?
Absolutely. So in addition to smallholders being a community that all of us feel very passionate about supporting, 2.2 million Americans are working in the coffee industry. There are a tremendous number of folks who work in the industry here in the U.S. And I think it's this power of 2.2 million Americans who work in the industry. Over 60% of Americans consume coffee on a regular basis. And so we have a tremendous contribution as consumers to this cause. And so I think that we have a clear constituency of those in the industry and those of us who love to drink coffee every day that can really work towards addressing some of the challenges faced by producers.
What is
so last year?
Go ahead.
Oh, sure. Okay. So last year, WCR commissioned a study by Michigan State University economists who estimated that the investment gap in agricultural R&D to support coffee is $452 million a year. But that's a global investment gap. If you figure that the U.S. consumes 16% of the world's coffee, then 16% of that $452 million investment gap is $72 million, which is, it's getting smaller. We're shrinking the problem and trying to tackle what, is our fair share in this world. So when we think about what we in the U.S. can do is we can contribute to our fair share of the investment in agricultural R&D to support coffee farmers, not only domestically here in California, in Hawaii and Puerto Rico, but also abroad.
And to what extent do you think we're going to see coffee cultivation happen here in the United States? Have there been studies looking at the kind of weather that we're going to be facing in the future and whether it's conducive to growing coffee here?
So what's exciting about plants, and I was trained as a plant scientist, so I always love to talk about trees the most, is that plants, of course, thrive in a wide range of production environments. And I think what we look to in coffee is there's what nature has given us, different species of coffee, and certainly a number of growers across the U.S. are experimenting with different species, and Arabica and Robusta in particular. Those are two species of coffee. And I think that there's what nature has given us, which are the building blocks of what we can start with, and then there's breeding. And so I think with breeding, we can develop varieties that actually can thrive in a range of production environments. And so while production in the US is probably not so successful in the next 5 or 10 years, certainly there's possibilities of expanding land area with coffee production. But one of the big challenges will ultimately be automation and mechanization. So what it takes to harvest coffee and to manage a coffee farm requires quite a bit of labor. And so when we think about the agricultural community, certainly across California, labor availability is a challenge, and trying to figure out how to do it and ensure that it works for all partners across the production system, and to make sure that everyone who's contributing to coffee production can succeed. So we're probably going to need to figure out things like mechanization and automation to support coffee farmers if we do develop varieties that can work in this environment.
We're talking with Vern Long, CEO of World Coffee Research, a global agricultural research organization. Also with us, the CEO of Atomo Coffee, a Seattle-based beanless coffee startup, Andy Kleitch. Andy, thank you very much for being with us. Share with us what led you to build your business around beanless coffee.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Really, our vision here is to have coffee be available for the next 100 years, right? We love coffee, and we wanted to find a way that we could make coffee be sustainable and not have the environmental impacts that it currently has today. And we've done that by really looking at how could we replicate coffee? How could we take things that are typically thrown away, like waste streams, and how could we turn that into your favorite beverage? How could we replicate the experience, the ritual, the aroma, the taste, the mouthfeel, and even that caffeine experience that you expect from coffee? Like, could we do that in a way that's more sustainable for the planet?
And you use date seeds as a way of doing that?
Yeah, one of the amazing inventions that we've come up with, and we've been at this for 5 years, one of the amazing inventions is that we were able to use date pits from Coachella Valley. So, you know, just east of you out there in the Palm Desert, Palm Springs region, that is one of the largest areas where they grow dates and in the U.S., and those dates have pits, and those pits are typically thrown away. And if you've ever bought like an RX bar or a Luna bar or any kind of bar that has a date paste in it, that date paste is coming from that region. And those pits are thrown away, and there's 10,000 pounds easily a day of date pits that are being thrown away. And we go around to those farmers and we pick up those date pits, bring them back to a facility in Coachella where we wash them off and dry them. And then we prepare them for use in our coffee. And over 50% of our coffee uses upcycled materials like date pits.
Do you roast it in the same way you would roast coffee beans?
Yeah, we do. In fact, we have a coffee roaster. But what we found with date pits is, if you were to take a date pit and roast it, it does not taste like coffee. I can tell you that. So what we've had to discover is a few things. We soak it in a marinade. Think about like a steak that you would soak in a marinade. We soak these date pits in a marinade. It does two things. One, it kind of takes away and removes a lot of the off notes that we don't like. And it infuses the date with our marinade. And when we then roast that date pit, there's what we call a Cross-Maillard reaction. There's a reaction between the date pit and our marinade that when roasted, taken through a thermal reaction, it actually generates the coffee compounds that we're targeting.
And so is there any caffeine that comes from that process, just like the natural caffeine with coffee?
Yeah, that is the biggest question that we always get, right? There are 60 plants that actually have caffeine. And so part of our goal was to find, like, how can we find the most sustainable caffeine and what would be the best caffeine buzz to offer? And what we settled on right now is caffeine from a decaffeinated green tea. So I'm sure you've bought green tea before, maybe even a decaffeinated green tea. And we take that caffeine that's been extracted from green tea and we add it to our coffee. And what people tell us is that it provides a more mellow caffeine experience. So espresso is like a rocket ship. If you have an espresso, you kind of get this really intense caffeine high and then you get a really big crash. And what we found with our coffee is that the green tea caffeine actually provides more of a sustained mellow rise and a mellow drop off as well.
Fat is sort of a Franken drink here with all the different upcycled elements that you're talking about. You said 5 years that you spent on this, and most of it, I'm assuming, is getting the taste right.
That's right. The research and development. I mean, there are, you know, probably about 15 ingredients right now that go into making up our coffee. And we're always trying new ingredients. We have things in our coffee like guava, lemon, millet, sunflower, fenugreek, date pits, you know, caffeine from that decaffeinated green tea. And so we've really been able to take all of these ingredients that you would not normally associate with coffee, but we've been able to identify compounds in each one of those that when we bring them all together and react them together, it generates exactly what you would expect from a coffee.
It's just hard for me to imagine lemon in that concoction actually makes it taste like, but I understand it's the chemical reaction of all of those different things in it that give you the flavor profile that you're looking for. This is absolutely fascinating, but what, you know, all the labor that you're talking about of amassing these different foods to put in it, these different ingredients, how does the cost compare to making a cup of coffee using coffee beans?
Yeah, it's been a long journey for us. When we first started out, our coffee was probably about, you know, $20 a pound just for the ingredients, you know, and so we knew we had to bring that cost down. So really it's finding sustainable ingredients. That's our number one driver, like ingredients that don't cause any deforestation, finding those that require less land use, and then finding those that are frankly inexpensive enough so we can make a coffee that tastes like coffee and is better for the planet and is as cheap to produce as coffee. And we've actually just achieved that. So now for us, our ingredient cost is around $4.50 a pound, which is really equivalent to what a specialty coffee roaster, if they're buying a specialty bean, they're paying $4.50 a pound for green coffee today. So we've achieved parity with the price of green coffee.
Andy, thank you so much for telling us about how Atomo Coffee puts together this beanless coffee product. And in fact, it is available to be tasted in Southern California at Eagle Rock Penny Oven on Colorado Boulevard. It's the first place selling Atomo beanless coffee in the Los Angeles area. Andy Kleitsch, thank you so much for talking about the product that you and your team has developed up there at Atomo Coffee in Seattle. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Andy Kleitsch, CEO of Atomo Coffee, and my thanks to Vern Long, CEO of World Coffee Research, as we talk about the future of one of America's favorite refreshments. Coming up, we'll talk about the changing makeup of the Republican Party with noted GOP pollster Patrick Ruffini. Party of the People, Inside the Multiracial Populist Coalition, Remaking the GOP is his new book. We'll be back in just 1 minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us, and I hope you'll sign up for Air Talk Weekly, the brand new newsletter that I write along with our Film Week production team. Each week, I share some of my thoughts on the program, some of the things that we've done, and the listener feedback that we get. I also share upcoming special events off the air that I'm involved with, and we highlight our segments of the week, and I share my thoughts about what our guests had to say and a little bit of background on the topic. So it allows you to stay up to date on Air Talk, even if you don't have a chance to listen to the program every day. I encourage you to sign up. It just arrives, of course, free in your email inbox every Friday midday. You can sign up right now by visiting laist.com/airtalk. That's laist.com/airtalk. And you'll see the little box there where you can enter your email address. We would love to have you as a subscriber to the free AirTalk weekly newsletter that comes out midday on Fridays. I'm joined now by the author of Party of the People Inside the Multiracial Populist Coalition Remaking the GOP, Patrick Ruffini. He's a Republican pollster, the co-founder of Echelon Insights, which is a polling and analytics firm based in Alexandria, Virginia. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to be here.
Your career goes back to working for former President George W. Bush, and we've seen the Republican Party shift so much from one that was largely a conservative party into one that is much more of a populist party. And Donald Trump, of course, the central figure who drives so much of what happens in the present Republican Party. How has that affected the composition of the membership of the party, of the voters who vote Republican?
I think that so many times people talk about this shift in the context of just the leaders who have changed. And it's obviously true that Donald Trump is a just much different type of personality, a much different type of political figure, not just within the Republican Party, but for the country as a whole. And as a result, I think so much of this is chalked up to Trump's exceptionalism, Trump's unique personal characteristics. But when you look at, the way that voters have been trending, even long before Trump, it had been the case, even going back to 2000, 2004, when you had the book, What's the Matter with Kansas, written by Thomas Frank, where he talks about, these people from poor rural communities starting to vote Republicans against their economic self-interest. He was writing, of course, from a progressive perspective. So we had already seen this. And then Trump, because of his unique personal characteristics, his populist positions, accelerates this trend even further, and does so to the point where, in 2024, he's leading in a lot of the polls. And he's leading in a lot of the polls specifically because he's doing better with minority voters. He's doing better with African-American voters, better with Latino voters. We saw some of that in 2020. But it seems like if these polls are right, we're going to see a lot more of it in 2024.
The question for me is how much of this is the appeal of Trump or the comparative lack of appeal of Joe Biden, and how much of it is really the populist policies of the current Republican Party? Can you disentangle that?
Well, look, I think that you really are talking primarily personality is one aspect of this for sure. But just where the country is from a, what has happened in the last few years with the rise of inflation and the situation on the border. It is always true that voters are always looking to solve in candidates, and they're looking for candidates who can solve, I think, for what they perceive as the deficiencies in, let's say, current leadership. So you look at 2020, and Joe Biden wins because he is perceived as a stable, calm, rational alternative to the chaos of the Trump era. And in fast forward to 2024, and I think, people, whether it's a reaction to Biden's age, they perceive to some extent a lack of energy. They perceive a lack of control over events, whether that's events on the border, whether that's events globally, whether that is rising prices at home. And they perceive Trump ironically, right? I mean, just given his, what his persona was throughout his entire presidency, as maybe either a steadier hand or a stronger leader who can exert his will on these events. And so I think that to a large degree, it's that intersection of, what really are the conditions of the country right now? What's the state of the country right now? And how does Trump, either Trump or Biden, solve for that?
We're talking with Republican pollster Patrick Ruffini, Party of the People, inside the multiracial populist coalition remaking the GOP. The argument you make is that the Republican Party is really becoming the party of the non-college educated, and a party that in recent decades has been highly, highly white is now becoming more diverse with non-college educated African Americans and Latinos as a part of that composition. And I'm just wondering, what do you think that they're seeing in Republicanism that is in their economic best interests? Certainly with the first term with Trump, there we saw significant amounts of federal spending, which has continued under Biden. It's not like Trump was a conservative when it came to fiscal spending. So if there's concerns about servicing the debt down the road, Trump wasn't the answer there. And with Trump's attitudes toward immigration, that, of course, has issues for being able to service the economy with immigrant workers and the availability of that, as we in California face a labor shortage. So I just wonder how did they see Trump as the answer?
Yeah, I mean, it's I think people are, let's say, responding to no more and no less than, really, frankly, what were the economic headlines when Trump was president versus what the economic headlines are when Biden was president? I think that there is very little evaluation, let's say, of, well, what policies did Trump pass or Biden pass, and how does that affect me? I mean, people aren't computing that, nor do I think we should expect them to. Trump's economic performance, I mean, this is consistent. This was consistent in polls at the time, and it's consistent in polls right now, was viewed very favorably. It was viewed as kind of a strong point, like even, you know, it was not quite as, because things were so good. I think people felt like they could focus on other things, and those other things maybe led them to the conclusion that Trump wasn't the best choice in 2020, but he always retained this strength on the economy. Now, when you go into 2024, and I wouldn't say things are bad, let's say on any an objective front, there's clearly a lot of jobs. There's clearly inflation is down, and at least that's what Biden would argue. But things feel very unsettled, right? Prices have increased a lot. And people feel like housing is a major, major problem. Healthcare costs continue to go up and up and up. And I think there's just more just generally focus on that, those downsides of the economy. And that's where the nostalgia, right, for the just purely what the economic headlines were in the Trump administration, in the Trump era. And that's really the difference for a lot of people.
We're talking with Patrick Ruffini, author of Party of the People, inside the multiracial populist coalition remaking the GOP. When we come back, we'll talk about the factor of abortion rights and how that factors in, as many Republican officials very concerned about the Dobbs decision, what the effect of it will be in the polls again with this election, as we've seen it do damage to Republican candidates a couple of years ago. We'll find out what Patrick thinks about abortion as an issue and how it factors in to the composition of Republican voters of today. We'll be back in just 1 minute on Air Talk. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle with pollster and consultant Patrick Ruffini, author of Party of the People, Inside the Multiracial Populist Coalition, Remaking the GOP. Patrick's thesis is that data shows that the GOP, Democrats have moved away from their working class constituency, that it's Republicans who've gained from that and benefited, and that the GOP has largely become party of non-college educated working class voters, and that it is becoming more diverse, despite the fact when you put on a Republican National Convention and watch it on TV, it's a sea of white people at the convention. But Patrick says that is changing somewhat with more Latino and Black voters being willing to vote Republican. Patrick, I do wonder, though, about the political damage done to the Republican Party by abortion restriction laws in such a significant number of states here in the U.S. And when these have been put as referenda before voters, voters even in highly conservative states have turned down abortion restrictions. So how do you see this factoring into efforts to appeal to more Latino and African-American voters? Because my understanding, particularly with Black voters, abortion rights are a very high priority, and even for significant numbers of Latinos.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly been a complication, right, for Republicans looking to either run up the score in some elections in the last, particularly, and I'm thinking the 2022 midterms, and potentially in the Senate races, right, in this cycle where there really was a hope that Republicans could, you know, score a generational Senate majority in 2024 based on the composition of the map. I do think I view this a little bit differently in that, you know, what you do often see in a lot of states is when people have the opportunity to isolate, right, their vote on this abortion rights measure. Yes, they do vote for the abortion rights side. And this is true in places like Ohio. It's true in places like Michigan and all the states that have had it. But once that's happened, right, the issue tends to be decided, and people are still really voting for governors, for senators, for mayors on other issues, not just abortion rights. They're voting primarily on the economy. For federal races, they may be voting on immigration. They may be voting on foreign policy. So I think that the idea that to some extent, I mean, when you have these measures on the ballot, I think they have driven turnout to an extent for Democrats. And so that they're really trying to get these measures on the ballot so they can drive turnout again in 2024. But my counterpoint to that would be that yes, they drove turnout in these very low turnout elections. When you have a presidential race on the ballot, that's what's bringing voters out. And that's how people are deciding. And, in many cases, you've had Republican governors who have signed some of these abortion bans that have been reelected comfortably in states like Ohio, Florida, and a number of other places.
You know, I understand Latinos have varied views about illegal immigration, and that there are immigration hawks among Latinos in the United States. So I do understand how there'd be Latinos who would support a Republican Party that wants to see a significant crackdown on illegal immigration. But I just wonder what the ceiling for that is, because my sense is that the majority of Latinos are deeply offended by characterizations of illegal immigrants or even illegal immigration as being this sort of danger to the country, and that people seeking to come into the United States who are undocumented pose a threat to others. That kind of rhetoric that we certainly hear from Donald Trump, it just seems to me there's going to be a ceiling on the number of Latinos who are willing to overlook that. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, so in 2016, right, I mean, 2016 was the height of this, right, where Trump, made comments, like disparaging comments towards Mexican Americans and people crossing the border in his announcement speech. And those things came to define his campaign. Now, what's interesting is that in that election, right, Trump does no worse among Latinos than Mitt Romney did, right? So, if it was going to, if something like that was going to manifest, you know, you really would have seen it, you know, a major backlash in 2016. And as a Republican at the time, I was very worried that that could happen. And then, of course, in 2024, I think, this issue kind of dies down. The whole issue of immigration or his immigration rhetoric dies down. And I think Trump is able to make gains among Latinos. But I think the current border situation and the current border crisis is just an entirely different issue than anything that was happening in 2016, where, again, I think the main issue was, you know, what are you going to do with people already here? And that was something that, you know, Latinos in the United States could identify, right? They identified the people who are already in the country, maybe legally, maybe illegally, as people like themselves. I think that today it's a different story. You have Latinos who have been in the country for two and three generations. You have more and more people like that, and who don't necessarily identify, right, in the same way with people who are just crossing the border today, some of whom do not necessarily come from the countries that they came from, or do not even come from the same parts of the world that they came from. And I think, look, there's been a very big history in this country of you've had waves of immigrants. I mean, we are a country of immigrants, that the vast majority of people today who, you know, are for some form of immigration restriction have at some point, their families have been immigrants to the United States. So I think that there's a long tradition of this. And that's especially true among the people who can vote. And the people who can vote in this country are citizens of the United States. They are either legal immigrants to the United States, or they were natural born citizens of the United States.
Patrick, I need to wrap, but thank you very much for being with us. Patrick Ruffini, author of Party of the People, Inside the Multiracial Populist Coalition, Remaking the GOP. He began his career working for President George W. Bush and the Republican National Committee. Thank you so much for joining us for another Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 9, right after Morning Edition.
Support for LAist comes from Apple TV+, presenting Lessons in Chemistry, starring Academy Award winner Brie Larson as scientist Elizabeth Zott.
Lessons in Chemistry is focused on a chemist who can't seem to quite make it through the political game and the misogyny that's happening in the world of science in the 50s. And as she's making her way through trying to make this great discovery about abiogenesis, about the origin of life, life happens to her. She experiences love and loss and an unexpected pregnancy. And all of these things move her into this direction of starting this TV show called Separate Six, where she becomes famous for something that she never thought she would be famous for, which is cooking. And that's because she has this unique perspective on it, where she's able to take all of the things that she loves about science and apply it to cooking. When you're thinking about Lessons in Chemistry, it's a play on so many different things. Yes, it's about science and chemistry, but it's also about that inexplicable connection of chemistry you can have when you're falling in love, the chemicals inside of our bodies and the chemistry that makes us up and makes life happen. And it's also about the way that life can surprise you, the way that you can't always predict and plan out. Elizabeth has to make real choices in terms of how her voice and how these things will affect her community, how it'll affect the crew and their pay. In this case, we're telling a story about a woman. And so for me, it relieves the pressure when there's a lot of women in the room, because then it's not just up to me to decide what female representation is in this case. There's so many examples on screen, but then you also have it behind the camera as well. So whether it's props or production design or costumes, you're getting that experience in every layer of it. So it was very important to us that you were seeing various representations of what it is to be a woman, to advocate for yourself, to rise and fall.
Asia Naomi King stars as Elizabeth's neighbor, Harriet Sloan.
She's a phenomenal woman. I am so inspired by her. I am so in love with her. She is driven. She has this moral compass. She really seeks out justice in every aspect of her life. But she's so much more than that. She's a great friend. She's a great mother and wife. And she's an activist. And she really takes part in her community. And part of what pushes her forward is that she chose to be a mother. And I just found a lot of those themes really moving and palpable with like what's important to me in my life and the things that I seek out, self-worth and community and love, but beyond romantic love, like love in the greater sense, love of self, love of family, love of community. I just feel like people are going to want to engage in this story, that it's going to remind them of their own capacity for greatness.
Lessons in Chemistry is a PGA, SAG, WGA, NAACP Image Award, 4-time Critics' Choice nominee, and 2024 DGA Award winner, hailed a triumph by Decider. More on Lessons in Chemistry at fyc.appletvplus.com.